Welcome once again to Leto's Law. Here's Steve Leto.
I had several people send me this story as the case unfolded, but the sentencing happened. And Tom sent me a note and said, Steve, check it out. She's been sentenced. I know you've been following the story. People suspect it. But life for how to murder your husband, author, in spouse death. And it is exactly as you think. A woman who wrote something entitled How to Murder Your Husband was married to somebody who died. She has now been convicted of his death, and people note the irony of the fact that she had written that, and so on. So this is out of Portland. The Associated Press reports this. A self-published romance novelist who once wrote an online essay called How to Murder Your Husband was sentenced Monday to life in prison with the possibility of parole, but she is sentenced for murdering her husband at his workplace in Portland 4 years ago. She was convicted of second-degree murder back in May following a seven-week trial. Her sentence Monday includes the possibility of parole after 25 years in custody. KGW reported, that's a TV station. So 25 years in custody at the age of 71. Let's see, carry the 6, 9, 4. Let's see here. Oh, hang on a second. She could get out when she's 96 years old. Prosecutors said that they believe she fatally shot her husband inside the now-closed Oregon Culinary Institute, where he worked in 2018, because she stood to gain financially from his life insurance payout. The case drew national attention because of the essay that she had written years earlier, but the piece was not permitted as evidence at trial, and I'll explain that in a second. The prosecution told jurors the couple had been facing financial difficulties at the time, and they contended that she had researched and purchased a weapon online and then later bought one, and they think that's how it all played out. Her attorney argued the state's evidence was circumstantial, disputed the claims of financial trouble, and brought in witnesses who testified of the couple's strong and loving relationship. She also took the stand and said she and her husband had both purchased life insurance policies as part of their retirement planning and had a plan to reduce their debt. She also said her research into the weaponry was in preparation for a future novel entitled What to Do If You Get Acquitted After Killing Your Husband. Now, I'm just joking. She did not actually write that. No. So she's going to prison, possibly, for 25 years. And the fact that she wrote the essay, How to Murder Your Husband, was not permitted as evidence at trial. And I had several people ask me about this, and they assumed it had gotten into evidence. And when I said, I don't think it got into evidence, because when I first heard the story, I suspected it didn't. And I had people say, what? How would that not get into evidence? And here is the thing. There are rules of evidence, and there's classes called evidence that you take in law school. In fact, the class is so convoluted and complicated, it's often broken into two, evidence one and evidence two. And you discuss all kinds of things, and you quite often study the federal rules of evidence, the FREs, and many states have their own rules of evidence, such as Michigan's, the MREs. It's not meal ready to eat, it's Michigan rules of evidence. And interestingly, Michigan has pretty much just adopted the federal rules with some minor modifications, such that if there is an FRE 401, which there is, there's likewise an MRE 401, which reads pretty much the same. And so the rules of evidence dictate how courts handle evidence, whether it gets admitted, what kinds of evidence can get admitted, what can be done with the evidence, so on and so forth. And so the underlying rules regarding evidence start with a rule that says, relevant evidence is admissible. Irrelevant evidence is inadmissible. So if someone seeks to introduce evidence during a trial and the other side objects and goes, that's irrelevant, Your Honor, if the court finds it's irrelevant, it is inadmissible. However, the judge goes, no, I believe this is relevant. Well, generally speaking, it's admissible. Now, you might say, Steve, you just added some weasel words there by saying generally. Generally, it's admissible? I thought you said all relevant evidence is admissible. Well, not all. You see, there's a rule called 403. 403 says, although relevant, evidence may be excluded from trial if it does any of the following things. So for instance, if it's cumulative evidence, there's too much evidence. Somewhere along the line, the court can say, hey, look, we've got enough here. And the example I like to give is, suppose a crime was committed at the 50-yard line during a University of Michigan home football game, and 110,000 people saw it live, and millions more saw it on television. Theoretically, you could call 110,000 witnesses who could all say, I was watching, I saw it happen. You don't need to call 110,000 witnesses. You call two or three, the ones with the best vantage point, and leave it at that. But if you kept calling witnesses over and over again, different witnesses, but they're all testifying the same thing, eventually somebody can object and say 403. It might be relevant, but it's cumulative, and it's not serving any function after you get a few people in. But one of the things that they talk about is whether or not the evidence is substantially more prejudicial than it is probative. Probative is what we talk about with what does this piece of evidence tend to prove? Okay? What does it tend to prove? What is the subject for which it is probative? Okay? So you witness an incident happening at a 7-Eleven. Something's going on. Your sixth sense tells you something's going on. As you approach the front door of the 7-Eleven, a guy comes running out, screaming, I can't believe I just robbed the 7-Eleven, and he takes off. Okay? Can you testify that you saw the guy running out of the 7-Eleven saying, I can't believe I just robbed a 7-Eleven? Yeah, it's 401 relevant. I mean, obviously, it's relevant. But what does it tend to prove that the guy came running out and yelled that? And by the way, you go inside and the guy goes, I just got robbed. There's nobody else in the building. It would tend to show that the defendant, if that's who this person saw, running out of the building yelling, I just robbed a 7-Eleven, would tend to suggest that that guy just robbed a 7-Eleven. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. So that's the probative nature of evidence. What would evidence be that is substantially more prejudicial than it is probative? Meaning that It slants things really, really hard in one direction in an unfair way. And I actually went online as trying to find some good examples of this. And unfortunately, most of the good examples are things I can't talk about on this channel. So I'll just go with one I made up. Okay? So let's suppose that you're a defendant and you have been arrested and are now charged with a crime. You are on trial for that crime they claim you committed. You have a clean record. You've never been convicted of anything in your entire life. You have been arrested once before, 10 years ago, coincidentally for the same type of crime you are now charged with. And the prosecution wants to introduce into evidence that you were previously arrested for a similar crime, not convicted. Arrested for. So the defense finds out that the prosecution is going to go there, or the prosecution starts going there, you can object, and your objection is not relevance in the 401 sense, it's relevance in the 403 sense. Because some jurors might say, if you ask them, yes, if he's been arrested for that before, and he's arrested for it again, that might suggest that this guy did it this time. Wait a second. He was arrested, but not convicted? What does that prove? Doesn't prove anything. Literally. It proves he was arrested. And the fact that he was arrested 10 years ago is not relevant to this particular charge. Again, I can see where a juror might go, but you know something? What are the odds that somebody gets arrested twice for the same thing? 10 years apart? It might be kind of a fluke, but it doesn't make him guilty, and it shouldn't get considered as evidence. That would be substantially more prejudicial than probative on the issue of whether this defendant committed this crime. Okay? So I know some of you are going to go, Steve, no. If you've been arrested twice, I think he did it. He didn't do it. I just made up those facts. It's a hypothetical. Okay? So there are situations where somebody wants to introduce something where people say, but that's good. That's real. That's interesting. I can see. So there you go. I suspect that when somebody pointed out that she had written an essay entitled How to Murder Your Husband, okay? I suspect that the court read it and looked at it and said, you know something? Although that's certainly interesting, it doesn't prove she murdered her husband. It depends on how long ago she wrote it, among other things. And also, did it describe the method that this murder was done by? And some people are going to ask this, so I'll address it now. Let's suppose, and I'm making stuff up here, but let's suppose in the essay, How to Murder Your Husband, she described doing it with a bizarre poison only found in an obscure island off the coast of Papua New Guinea. And it turns out that this man here was murdered by the use of an obscure poison only found on an island off the coast of Papua New Guinea. That might get in, but that would not be getting in to prove directly the fact that the headline says how to murder somebody and she murdered somebody. It would be that odd little fact. What are the odds of somebody having that little factoid in an article, and then a poisoning occurs just like it, and it's the only type of poisoning that happens like that in the entire United States this century, that kind of thing. Possibly. But simply saying that she wrote an article entitled How to Murder Your Husband, and then her husband gets murdered, that's not going to get in. That's substantially more prejudicial than probative. And remember that the rule starts with, although relevant, evidence may still be excluded. So the courts are saying that that could be relevant, but the small amount of relevance it has does not outweigh how prejudicial it is. Because most jurors who want to get home for lunch are going to say, she wrote an essay called How to Murder Your Husband and somebody murdered her husband. Yeah, she did it. So there you go. But she got life in prison. And it's life for the How to Murder Your Husband author in the spouse death that happened in Oregon. Stories from the Associated Press. Tom sent me the update. Thanks. Questions or comments, put them below. Let's talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you for watching Leto's Law. Letting the cat out of the bag is a whole lot easier than putting it back in.